Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. NPR is celebrating its 50th anniversary in 2021, and my guest today has written an account of four gender barrier-breaking women who have come to define the sound and journalistic professionalism of the organization for much of those 50 years. Susan Stamberg was the first woman to become an anchor of a national news broadcast, and her innate curiosity and storytelling sense about matters both weighty, edifying, or trivial has defined the sound of the network. Cokie Roberts was the first woman to be acknowledged as a journalistic Washington insider and was a consummate explainer of the workings of Congress and national politics. Linda Wertheimer was also one of the best in covering Congress and anchored the network's first breakthrough moment when NPR became the first network to broadcast a congressional debate from start to finish. That was the Panama Canal Treaty. And Nina Totenberg, who changed the way the media covered the Supreme Court and broadcast important scoops on the court's workings, including the story of Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. These four are known as the founding mothers of NPR. Journalist and writer Lisa Napoli has told their story, as well as the early story of NPR's beginnings and the story of how these four and other women broke through the gender barrier in broadcasting in her book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. Lisa Napoli was a reporter for Marketplace, New York Times, Cyber Times, and at MSNBC. She's also the author of Up All Night, a book on the founding of CNN. She'll be talking about her new book Thursday, July 8th at 7 o'clock in a virtual event at Magic City Books along with Public Radio Tulsa, and it's for members of the station only. You can learn more at publicradiotulsa.org on how to register. And Lisa Napoli is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Lisa Napoli, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your books, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, tell the story of these four founding journalists at NPR that have made such a difference in NPR's trajectory. But it's a larger story than those four journalists' story. It's more a story of women in broadcasting and in journalism, the creation of public broadcasting. What interested you in telling these four journalist stories and how you extrapolated that to tell a larger story?
Well, you know, my last book was about the creation of CNN that was published in 2020 around the 40th anniversary of the first all-news cable channel, which, by the way, had a lot of Oklahoman influence, but we can talk about that later. So finishing that as a career journalist and understanding the context of this powerful media force of cable news, which transformed the news industry, made me really interested in the history of NPR. I've spent a little time in public radio myself, but of course, as a woman who came up behind these ladies, I was just curious about the sort of juxtaposition of these stories. And when I saw that NPR's 50th anniversary was this year, that kind of lit the fire under me and my publisher to get that story out. And it really was a wonderful exercise in fact-finding. The women's stories are individually also interesting and different, even though they landed in the same place. And then you've got, like you said, the story of feminism and the rise of public radio all together in that nice little package. Or at least I hope that's what I did, put it all in one nice little package.
Now, you worked at Marketplace for a while. Let me ask you, do these personas of these four founding mothers of NPR, did they loom large even over your newsroom?
I'd have to say I'd be lying if I said that they were. I think that they did in a quiet way, not necessarily in a large way. And ever since this book came out a few months ago, I've heard from a lot of people who were either career public radio people or just women, you know, in early in their careers. And they've said, oh, yeah, I knew these women, or at least some of these women, I'm familiar with their stories a little bit, but I had no idea the context. And that's the thrill for me as a writer, is that I'm shining a spotlight on names that people knew and an institution that people know. Obviously, if they're listening to this, they do. But putting those puzzle pieces together and realizing just how impactful these women were has been really interesting. But no, it wasn't like every day we all went to work and said, oh, we want to be Susan Stamberg, or oh, thank goodness for Linda Wertheimer. We knew they were huge giants, but the historical context wasn't there.
Of course, Marketplace is separate from NPR, so it's not like they were in your newsroom.
Right, exactly. But even women I've talked with who have grown up in the NPR newsroom, or, you know, grown up meaning work their careers through the NPR newsroom, knew these women were forces, of course, but the bigger picture story wasn't something that was familiar to them. And that's what I love about writing and digging deeper. Yes, everybody knew who Ted Turner was at a certain point, but how did he get to be Ted Turner? How did CNN get to be CNN? How did Susan Stamberg get to be the founding mother of NPR? Where did she come from? And that's what's so interesting to me, those backstories, the context. Is so interesting and illuminating. And I don't think even a lot of people in NPR were familiar with that. And certainly, I don't think most listeners were familiar with her backstory, how she got to the job that she got to and became the force she became.
And I think that's also a big story you tell for people who have started listening to NPR. They probably started listening maybe 10, 20 years ago. But when you're talking about 50 years ago, it was a very right. different organization, and it was not heard by anybody in the first few. I mean, right. A big part of this story is how these women and NPR started to become relevant. Because I could say that, you know, your timeline basically focuses up to the end of the Frank Mankiewicz period of NPR running. Early 80s. It was still not as relevant as it is today. It wasn't even close, but it was starting to become relevant. And I think that will be interesting to a lot of longtime NPR listeners is just literally how run on a string the thing was for the first decade.
Yeah. Now it's the go-to source for so many people. But what's so interesting too is it wasn't just that NPR was, you know, an infant in the 70s when it launched. The media universe was so completely different. I mean, many people listening to this may have a hard time remembering, if they were alive then, that FM radio was this marginalized force, and that non-commercial radio, that radio in general was kind of they called it the hidden medium. It was kind of left for dead because TV was, you know, in its ascendance, or had ascended to the point where it had really the stranglehold on the American mindshare. So when NPR launched in the 70s, it was really an experiment, and nobody was really sure what was going to happen. It's not like it came out as this fully formed entity with all these programs and these well-known people working behind it. It was a bunch of people who believed in the power of radio on a community level, who were entrusted by the creation of the Public Broadcasting Act in the late 60s to come up with something new to serve the American people that wasn't happening with commercial media, television and radio. And of course, back then, three networks dominated everything that people heard and saw on the airwaves. So this was an experiment. And yes, as you say, I mean, in the early days, they struggled. And of course, anybody who's worked for a startup knows that there's a lot of arduous work that happens with the startup, but there's also a lot of joy with it too, because the expectations are so low and the audience is so small, you can experiment. And those experimental days, in those early days, are what really formed what has become this NPR sound that people know and love and revere and trust. But it had, again, it's going back to the roots. And the roots are saying, you know, Susan Stamberg was the first woman to host a national nightly newscast. And it wasn't a calculated decision. It was just, we need somebody who embodies this idea of an alternative sound to commercial media. And that person is it. And, oh, she happens to be a woman. But, wow, no one's ever put a woman in that kind of position before, because women were not allowed to be on the air in any measurable sense, except maybe doing commercials or, you know, frivolous things. So the idea that all of that happened in the 70s, I think, is just so interesting and important.
And I think in your author's note at the beginning, you said these four women came to prominence by accident as much as anything.
Yes.
And in case of Susan Stamberg, you know, one of the things I want to ask you is what we need to know about each of these women. I think let's start with Susan Stamberg. The fact that she became the host of All Things Considered basically because they couldn't find a host who could actually do the job, keep the train on time. It was, you know, it was a 90-minute show in those days, and you had a host who would speak extemporaneously. And, you know, a clock doesn't like extemporaneous speaking.
Exactly. Well, you know, they could have hired traditional broadcasters from the commercial broadcast media if that, you know, if people were willing to take a flyer and come work for a place that might not work out. But instead, under the auspices of a man named Bill Siemering, who most people in public radio consider to be the founding father of public radio,
yes.
He came from Wisconsin and Buffalo, where he'd worked in local non-commercial radio before. And his mandate to the staff was, don't sound like Walter Cronkite. Not that there's anything wrong with Walter Cronkite, but our job is to come up with a more conversational, humane style, and not to tell stories that are ambulance chasing, but to tell stories that are stories about people and issues through the lens of people. And so that was, you know, it sounds so obvious now, but that was revolutionary in the 70s, that Bill's commitment was for that. And so he basically hired people who he knew would help support that. And that included women. Women, as I said, had a hard time getting jobs that were beyond, you know, research or secretarial jobs in the media, well, anywhere for that matter. And he didn't have that bias. He wanted people who were willing to work in this concept that he had. And Susan embodied that more than anybody else. She wasn't the first host, but she was elevated to host because the young producer who was working with her at the time said, this woman embodies everything that Bill Siemering is teaching us that we need to sound like. And sure enough, it was as if she was meant to be a radio host.
Yeah.
I mean, she was so natural at it. And she'd come from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. She wasn't from a fancy family. She was, you know, first person in her family to go to college. She went to an excellent school on scholarship. And, you know, a lot of the story, and as many stories, is just an accident of timing and a confluence of circumstance. And she embodies that. And to this day, you know, anybody listening knows that she's still active and incredible.
And what's interesting is she embodies that spirit of experimentation that you said was so present in NPR's beginning. She's a person that could go into a closet with Ira Flatow and see if a lifesaver does create, a green mint lifesaver does have a spark, or she could talk about art on the radio. She could do, she could tell her family's cranberry relish recipe, along with interviewing newsmakers and telling the news of the day. So she had that sort of embodiment of this idea of all things considered.
Yes, she created that embodiment of all things considered. That's what's so interesting. If it hadn't been in her hands or in her voice, it might have sounded completely different. But because once she slid into that co-anchor chair, she just personified exactly what it was that Bill Siemering and the other people at the very beginning of non-commercial or public radio, as we know it today, wanted it to sound like. So she created that sound. And everybody who'd come after her has tried to mimic that sound in their way, adapted it in their way. And, you know, she's just a powerful force, working in her 80s now. And there could be no more fervent supporter, advocate, person advocating for public radio.
Now, you contrast her with Linda Wertheimer. I think of Linda Wertheimer as being this, first, an incredible journalist, but this quiet competence that
exactly.
is. Yeah. And what's interesting is both of those two were present at the beginning, not on the air, but they were behind the scenes, and they were enormously important in getting the show launched because Susan was a talented editor. She'd been a producer at WAMU before and had been a host. Linda Wertheimer was one of the few people that knew how to put a show together from her time sort of following the BBC, an exchange program. So she knew at least how to get a whiteboard on the air on figuring up how to fill 90 minutes.
Right. Exactly. They both had this, they were thrilled to have jobs where they could do something other than marginalized sideline jobs as women, which is what their lot was, unfortunately. And they also were committed to this concept of this new place that they could help shape and form like a baby. And yes, it described it perfectly. Linda, whereas Susan was meant to be a salon hostess, whether it was on the air or in a house somewhere, at a university or wherever, a diplomat's wife, someone called her. She was a perfect diplomat's wife. Linda Wertheimer was a workhorse. She came from Carlsbad, New Mexico, where her father was a grocer, and she made her way to a very fancy college on scholarship, too. She was an ace student from the get-go. And here she is in Washington, D.C., with the chance to work for this brand-new network. And she basically, while Susan was sliding into the anchor desk, Linda was sliding into studying up on how Congress worked and recognizing that, you know, the workings of D.C. were important, especially when they were seen through the lens of somebody other than the traditional Washington, D.C. reporter, meaning a man. And so a woman wielding a microphone could ask questions of lawmakers differently than a man would. Not that the man was doing it wrong, but that there was an additional benefit to having another voice there. And so she studied up and learned the importance of, you know, the rules of Congress and the language of Congress and the people, the characters, and just basically changed the way that was covered. Before, we had C-SPAN, and we could see it as, you know, the American public couldn't see into the inner workings of government the way we can now. You know, we can go on Twitter, we can turn on C-SPAN or any cable channel, any channel, and hear and see the lawmakers doing their thing, for better or worse. But that wasn't the case in the 70s. So the fact that she could do that really added to the development of that kind of coverage.
My guest today is Lisa Napoli, journalist and author. Her latest book is titled Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. And she will be appearing in a virtual event later this month with Magic City Books, and sponsored by Public Radio Tulsa. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. And beyond Susan and Linda, of course, the other two of the quartet is Nina Totenberg and Cokie Roberts. Nina Totenberg, perhaps at first glance, you'd say, you know, maybe she's going to end up in the arts somewhere. But in fact, she was as dogged as Linda was. Nina was even more dogged in following a story. She went to college for just a couple of years, found it boring. And she, you know, even though there were very few opportunities, what opportunities she had, she ran with it, and she made herself indispensable.
Yes. I mean, they all embody the idea that you don't take no for an answer. And Nina worked her way, as you say, in an industry print, was not favorable to women either. And even though she kept having doors closed, she kept finding ways around them. And made her way to D.C. and had quite a reputation around D.C. as a terrific, dogged reporter. And basically, when NPR in its early years needed a workhorse reporter, the editor at the time knew about her and hired her, even though she knew nothing about radio. And, you know, NPR is now a place that people go to college to aspire to work for, either on a local level, the national level, or in, you know, adjacent places like where I was at Marketplace. But in the 70s, there wasn't this steady pipeline of journalism graduates coming out wanting to do that. There were very few people who understood how to work in radio, and that was a different world. It wasn't digital, it was tape, and, you know, literal tape that had to be cut with razor blades, and it just was not a thing. And Nina got hired. She needed a job. The printlet publication she'd worked for had gone out of business, and so she said, why not? I'll try it. And so she did, and she's still there, as you well know, and, you know, a force of nature, and redefined the way the Supreme Court was covered. In the early years, she covered everything in D.C., as everybody there did. There are very few people with single beats. There are very few people, period. And it's a great story because she was the daughter of a renowned violinist. And, yeah, that wasn't the direction she wanted to take in her life. She always knew that she wanted to be some sort of investigator, reporter, and that's obviously, it worked out.
Of course, she really changed the way people reported on the Supreme Court in an age where, yes, you can stick a camera and follow a debate as Congress did eventually with the advent of C-SPAN. And, you know, you can follow a press conference. The Supreme Court is one where it is literally no cameras, no recordings for the longest time. And Nina created this way of putting the drama of oral arguments on the radio.
Yeah.
And basically, she had the Nina Totenberg Supreme Court theater.
Exactly.
Where she would recount these conversations of oral arguments. And it was utterly engrossing, and it was enlightening, too.
Well, and as she said earlier in her career, there were many people who wouldn't be interested in that beat because it was a dry beat. And I think people are always surprised to find out that she doesn't have a legal background. And that, she says, worked in her favor because it made it possible for her to invent this way of telling the stories and also made her unafraid of asking questions that maybe somebody who did have the background might be kind of embarrassed to ask. I mean, that's how her friendship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg struck up back before Ruth Bader Ginsburg was the Supreme Court Justice. Nina called her up as a young woman. They were both younger women and earlier in their careers. And Nina read a brief that she had done and asked her questions. And she said, you know, I don't know you. Do you mind helping me out? And Ruth said, no problem. And from there, this lifelong friendship began. And, you know, I loved what Nina said earlier on in her career, and I'm sure she would say it now, too. And that is, you never know who you're going to meet and what's going to happen to them. And the whole exercise of becoming a reporter, or really anything, is the people you meet today might be Supreme Court justices tomorrow. So that was true in Nina's career. She met people both at the top of their game and then on their way up, and has institutional knowledge that very few people have, and fell in love with a beat that wasn't sexy. You know, the White House was the sexy beat. But that wasn't the direction that she wound up taking, and she made it into a beat that I'm sure there's 100 people who would love to do, more than that, would love to do that job themselves.
Now, the fourth of the quartet, Cokie Roberts, was born to cover Congress, the daughter of not one congressman, but two congressmen, mm-hmm. Hale and Lindy Boggs. She grew up with, you know, the Speaker of the House as a frequent House guest, Sam Rayburn. She knew politics from a very early age. And yet, when she came to NPR, the first idea was that she probably shouldn't cover Congress. I found that really interesting.
Isn't that interesting? And the fact that she didn't even really want to cover, she didn't even want to come back to D.C. at that stage in her life. She was very happily married, as she was till the end of her life. She was a very happy mother. She was freelancing in overseas, where her husband was a foreign correspondent, after some time in California. And when he took the transfer to D.C., she was very upset. She loved living in Greece. She wanted another foreign posting. And, you know, the exotic nature of living abroad and covering a universe that was completely, entirely unknown to her. And also what's interesting about her is that she didn't grow up like Nina did, wanting to be a journalist. That wasn't at the top of mind when she was a younger woman. So I loved her backstory and her family's story. Yes, of course, is you know, part of American history. Her parents alone, I relished every moment reading about both of them because they were such political forces and such entirely different political forces. But that's what's so interesting about Cokie. She seemed completely born to do the job that we all know she did. And yet that wasn't a job she wanted to do initially. And not only did she attack it gracefully, but she was a pioneer in a double sense because she was so good at NPR and so well regarded as a reporter that she was recruited to be on television. And that, of course, really changed her life even more because being on television elevated her to this, you know, world that people were not accustomed to seeing women talk routinely about politics, and they fell so in love with her and her no-nonsense approach that she opened so many doors for women. Again, I think that so many women working today probably don't even realize it because it seems so amazing that there was a time that women weren't allowed to cover politics, to talk about these issues, to be equal on the playing field with men. But that was not very long ago the case.
My guest is Lisa Napoli, a journalist and author. Her new book is titled Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you know, we do think of journalism as being one of the first fields where women were able to break through in a male-dominated vocation. But just because there were notable successes earlier in the history of work doesn't mean it was any easier. what I found interesting and amazing was how difficult it was for these women. They wouldn't take no for an answer, and they all found a way to come together in one place and make a difference, and perhaps make a difference beyond just NPR throughout all of broadcasting because of their successes.
Many women seem to, when they would either meet Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie in person or just hear them on the radio, they knew that the fact that women could now talk seriously, be taken seriously, that's the power of media, right? That's why when we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, when you see someone who looks like you in a position of power, in a position of being a spokesperson, you realize, well, maybe I can do that too. And it changes, it reframes the whole dialogue when somebody of color or a woman is in a position that you're used to seeing a white man in. And again, it's nothing wrong with white men. It's just that when that was all you saw, then you got the impression that women couldn't aspire to that kind of position in any part of society. I mean, for so long, women were relegated to certain professions and were expected to leave those professions when they got married and started families. So it was a different world, and these women are four women. There are, of course, many examples of people, many of whom are not famous, who did not become well-regarded or well-off, who've toiled hard in communities all around our nation and the world to set examples for the younger women and people behind them. But these women just were an interesting story juxtaposed with the creation of the network at that moment in time when women were struggling for equal rights.
And I think it's interesting, your book does share some of those stories of other women that that did break through the glass ceiling in broadcasting, television journalists and print journalists as well. So it's interesting that you do share this larger story as a part of these four women's stories about how women gained a foothold in journalism.
Yeah, and it was incrementally. You know, people always ask, they did with the CNN book too, what was the defining moment for CNN? Well, you know, it wasn't. People will say it was the Gulf War, but truthfully, it was an incremental acceptance of 24-hour news as cable came to be a dominant force around the nation and the world. And people got trained, as we did with cell phones more recently, people got trained to turn on the TV to watch news at all hours. And it was the same thing with NPR and with the women. It was an incremental sort of channeling of women. Women had broken through earlier. There, decades before, there were examples of women who were pioneers. And as you say, I mentioned some of them in the book. But it was this combustible moment of the 70s that took it to a different height. But yeah, rarely, as we know in our society, do things change instantly. It's usually incremental, just like growth. You know, babies grow up incrementally. It's a different kind of power.
And sometimes they have growing pains, and you relate that in the book as well. Lisa Napoli, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Journalist and writer Lisa Napoli speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. She'll be participating in a virtual event Thursday evening, July 8th at 7 o'clock with Public Radio Tulsa and Magic City Books. Attendance at the event will also include a copy of the book. You can register online at publicradiotulsa.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.